In a year's time, several big English cities will vote for a city region mayor, similar to the mayor we see in Greater London. Some commentators believe the introduction of these big city mayors has the potential to significantly disrupt the UK's system of government. While their executive powers will in some respects be constrained by other local politicians, these new mayors will have a much bigger electoral mandate than a typical council leader or an MP. So, for example, the mayor of Greater Manchester will be directly elected by over 2.5 million people. By comparison, the typical member of parliament for an English constituency is elected by around 72,000 people, and the typical council leader by around 6,000 people. So how big an impact will these new city mayors have on the established order? Will we start to see more conflicts between national and local politicians as a result of these changes? And will more powerful city region mayors result in wider changes to the way government works at the centre and to the constitutional fabric of the UK? Joining me to discuss these big questions, I have Lord Kerslake, Bob Kerslake, crossbench peer in the House of Lords and a former head of the Home Civil Service, and Joe Casebourne, Programme Director at the Institute for Government. Well, can you just give us a sense of what the division of labour is between national politicians and local politicians? How should we think about this?
Interestingly, I think we talk about the traditional role of local and central politicians. I think it's changed in my lifetime, actually. Right. I think the role of MPs has changed. Historically, MPs were very much elected to be in Westminster and saw their role very much as being in Westminster. Mm. Increasingly, with, I think, the breakdown of party allegiances, to be successful as an MP, to even get selected to be a candidate, you have to be much more of a constituency MP, dealing with local issues and taking those into government and elsewhere. Mm. And I think that brings MPs much more in line with, if you like, or close to and potentially in conflict with local councillors. So I think we've seen a change already. And you often find that there are quite significant tensions between MPs and their council because they are representing issues to the council on behalf of local residents. So I think it's changed a lot in the last 20, 30 years. Newly elected mayors, I suspect, will potentially exacerbate that because they will be, I think, more powerful than MPs. They'll have a higher profile than MPs. And I think increasingly, therefore, MPs will feel, unless they're in government, you know, which of these two options is the better deal? It's not at all surprising to me that Andy Burnham has thought, I'm going to go to be a mayor.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that. And I think, you know, explore in a bit more detail as to why we've seen some of this emergence in amongst our national politicians for these mayoral positions. But Joe, where do you think it is? What do you think some of the challenges for the MPs at the local level, particularly then how they manage if they are in cabinet and they are at, you know, at the central government making decisions, the relationships that we see there and how that plays out locally?
I think we're going, Whitehall and Westminster are both going to have to really adapt when we get this new powerful set of directly elected mayors. So whilst we've had the Mayor of London for a good few years now, having a whole cadre of kind of big national political figures is going to make it feel very different, as Bob was saying, I think, for local MPs in particular places where they have a directly elected mayor. So I think it is going to change the way Whitehall needs to think about how it deals with local leaders in that sense, and also change the way that Westminster operates. Is there going to be a cabinet of the mayors, as has been discussed in the past, or what mechanism should there be to bring mayors together to kind of talk directly to Whitehall, or will that happen in a more ad hoc way? So I think there's some really interesting yet unanswered questions.
No, Bob, how do you see central, I mean, you were head of the Home Civil Service and in a Secretary General for CLG. How do you think government is thinking about how it responds? I think they've spent a lot of time thinking about how the country should respond, but maybe less so about how the government's going to respond on these issues.
I think that's right. If you think of what drives a civil servant, how do they see the world? And I would say 80, sometimes 90% of their field of vision is upwards to ministers. Mm-hmm. That's how they interpret the world, and they think national programmes. So they're, in some senses, very uncertain about how to handle powerful local politicians And Boris Johnson was a master at this in tricks. If he didn't feel he was getting his way with civil servants, the call would go in to Mr. Osborne, and hey presto, something moved.
Right.
And I think we're just going to see a very much more complex, different and distributed system, actually, where power is going to lie in different places.
I mean, notwithstanding Johnson's particular attractions in terms of his personality and all the rest of it, does that say something about the electoral mandate that a mayor would have? You know, in the sense of you're saying Greater Manchester mayor, in theory at least, you know, there's 2.5 million people that are directly elected. You know, our council leaders in some respects are getting elected by, in some instances, a few thousand people. And I wonder whether there's, you know, there's something there about how that's going to shape or shake up.
They are.
The ability of national politicians to resist our city region mayors.
I think it will have an impact. A huge amount depends on how much, if you like, people take these metro mayors to their hearts.
Right.
And I think that in turn depends on whether the area identified has a genuine identity. Greater Manchester has that. Whereas some of the other areas being talked about for mayors, it's less clear cut. And if people don't connect with this, if they see it as another remote politician, another layer of government, and don't vote, then they'll become like police and crime commissioners, lacking profile, lacking mandate. So truthfully, we don't yet know how this will play out.
Yeah.
And certainly some of the kind of mayors for local authorities have not had kind of the scale of impact you might have sometimes thought. Some have, of course, Robin Wales, but it's not always been the case.
No.
So the truth is, I think it will hugely depend on how much people buy into the idea of metro mayors, see it as genuinely a new force for their area, and that in turn will give those mayors quite a lot of power.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. And I think in some of the non-metro areas, that's where it's much more difficult, because Greater Manchester clearly is a place that people understand and identify with. Is Greater Lincolnshire to the same extent, or East Anglia? Do people think of themselves as being from East Anglia?
No,
I think when you're thinking about identity, people think about their town or possibly their county, or if they're in a city region, the city region. But not all of the geographies of the new devolution deals and the directly elected mayors that go with them are like that. So I think in those areas it will be more difficult to persuade local electorates that this isn't just another layer of government kind of adding to bureaucracy, it's actually real power. And I think there the role of the Mayor of London that's sort of developed over time, we've seen there much more kind of power going to the mayor as you know, longevity of that role.
Yeah.
And I think, again, when you look at the polling that you recently did at Centre for Cities on what people care about locally, and it's health and housing, and not all of these mayors will actually have control over those powers originally. But if they are strong political figures, then no doubt they will get those powers over time as they show that they're being effective in powers like transport.
That's a good point. Yeah,
it is a very powerful point that you make, Sarah. And interestingly, despite the fact that the London mayor, at least in the early period, had very limited powers, actually, they did develop a profile and a persona and a presence, if you like, that enabled them to get far more power than actually was formerly there by way of responsibility.
Absolutely.
It's really quite remarkable. But then if you ask people in London, where do they live? They say, I live in London.
Yeah.
If you ask people in Bradford, do you live in Bradford or the Leeds city region? I think we know the answer.
I think we do know the answer, yeah. No, I think it's a very good point. And I think it's one of the issues that's often overlooked, isn't it? It's the identity element, not just for the identity purposes, but then the willingness of people to allow others to govern on their behalf over an area that they can feel is, you know, is their own. And I think that's often overlooked, I think.
And I think also if you think about mayors around the world, that we've seen people really kind of driving innovation at city level and changing the way cities are run. People like Mayor Park in Seoul, for instance, or Bloomberg in New York, or O'Malley in Baltimore, kind of using sort of data strategies or, you know, innovation or engaging citizens, really changing cities. But we are still some way off with our new directly elected mayors of having as much power as those US mayors, for instance, where they actually have significant power to raise revenue locally, and therefore, you know, what they can actually do with their city is a lot bigger. So I think we're definitely, it's a step change in the UK from where we've been with single authority mayors, but we're still not yet at the level of other global mayors around the world.
And it raises that interesting issue, and get your reflection. There's clearly a debate going on at the minute. On the one hand, some people worried that the mayors will be too powerful. And then on the other hand, there are others that say, and essentially the mayors will be not powerful enough, and they, you know, they'll be name only, and they won't be able to enact. I wonder where, you know, what you think around that, and particularly I wonder whether, you know, whether we do need powerful mayors for the reason, well, for several reasons. One, so they can actually do things, but actually so they can attract people to those posts that are, you know, partly, I guess, why Bloomberg wants to be New York mayor, or Johnson and Livingstone wanted to be London mayors, all other things being equal, was because there was something within the post itself that was attractive to them. But Bob, where do you sit on the not powerful enough, too powerful?
I think personally,
what's the balance at the minute?
I think the balance probably, and this is a fine core, is not powerful enough. I think they need to have more power, and they need to be able to exercise that power, if you like, within the context of, but not overly constrained by the combined authority. And a lot of the debate is how much can they do themselves and how much they have to do with the agreement of the combined authority.
Yeah.
But there are two caveats to that point, really. One is, a lot will depend how they exercise their power. And some of the most successful single authority mayors haven't felt the need to be the big I am. They've been immensely powerful.
Yeah.
Steve Bullock, I think,
is a
textbook
example
of how you can be a brilliant mayor and not feel the need to lord it over everybody, to coin a phrase. The second thing I'd say is we still don't really know how to get the accountability arrangements right. I'm chair of the Centre for Public Scrutiny. We're doing a lot of work on this at the moment. Because if we don't get that sense of a clear accountability and transparency about what combined authorities and mayors do, they will risk becoming as remote from the residents they purport to serve as central government.
Yeah,
I think that's a really key point. And we had an event at the Institute around a year ago now with Peter Salisbury, who was one of the mayors that was on the panel.
Yeah.
And he was talking about that accountability point, and again, making the case that these new mayors are very different. So he was saying that clearly you don't kind of win it, you don't become council leader through kind of winning it on the doorstep and through the pages of the Leicester Mercury. You actually become council leader by getting the support of your fellow councillors. Whereas once you're actually a mayor of a city, you've got that visibility, you've got direct accountability. He talked about people stopping him in the street to say, why aren't you doing X and Y, which just doesn't happen to council leaders. And he said it indeed didn't happen when he was an MP either. So I think it is different in terms of accountability. And visibility is another key point, with people thinking of that person as the figurehead for the whole place. So you can move from council leaders to kind of place-based leaders in a way that we haven't seen before.
And can that only be done through the directly elected model? You know, in a sense, you know, if you think about some of our core cities, Sheffield or Birmingham or Liverpool, Liverpool as a mayor, but you know, they're big places with, you know, and the personnel or the people running them ought to be much higher in the public eye than they currently are. Bob, I mean, what do you think?
I think you can do more, and of course one of the ones that was often quoted is Barcelona, where the mayor is an indirectly elected mayor. So, but you have to have a system where they are given very significant profile and power out with the people who directly elect them, i.e. the councillors.
Yeah.
And we've never quite made that work. The so-called strong leader model that we have in local authorities, really, they choose their cabinet.
Yeah.
That's about as far as it goes. They're still subject to annual elections by their party, aren't they, very often?
Yeah, not quite.
So in that sense, if you were going to do it that way, you'd have to be far more clear cut about the powers that go with being a mayor. And so far, we haven't found a way of making that work in this country. And hence the reason why I think people have moved to directly elected mayors. I've been a champion of directly elected mayors for cities for a long time.
Mm.
I still think we don't yet know, as I said earlier, how metro mayors, city regional mayors are going to play out.
Yeah.
And if I had a choice sometimes, I would have said I'd have really preferred just to have gone down the city mayor route in the first instance.
Yeah.
I think one thing to add to that is their kind of ability to wield soft power, I think, is where some of the kind of what's different about the mayoral model.
Yeah.
And again, kind of being able to convene local public service leaders to sort of sort out problems and coordinate people, and actually using their soft power against Whitehall and Westminster to some extent, which I think is different with the mayoral model. And as we were saying earlier, London mayors have proved very good at doing that over time, and people like George Ferguson have shown that it's possible to do that in other places too. So I think that soft power is a key thing you get.
Yeah, so do I. Of course, Bristol had a referendum whether they wanted to keep the mayor, a vote on whether they wanted to keep the mayor, and they did.
Yeah.
You know, despite quite a rigorous or vociferous campaign, is the right way to try and not do that.
No, quite. And the re-election, although George lost the second election, the turnout for the city itself was incredibly high. It was up around 45%, and in some of the more deprived wards, more difficult neighbourhoods, it was over 50%. So, you know, sense of galvanising and engaging with the population of these areas, I think it, in that respect, it's particularly effective. And there were worries in London that without a prominent personality, the numbers would go down. But actually, you know, the numbers actually were up, weren't they, in terms of the turnover, which I think is quite interesting. Do we have, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier on, Bob, about MPs becoming more constituency-based, more local knowledge-orientated, more engaged at the local level, councillors continuing to do that as well. Do we just have too many politicians playing in this space? I mean, the criticism is, you know, you hear, we don't need more politicians, whether it's a mayor or anything else. We don't need any more. You know, the active conversation in many places, we need to take out councillors, we don't need three in a ward anymore, we need, you know, and so on and so on. But I don't know, are we uniquely positioned or in the way that this country has lots of politicians of different stripes and persuasions or not really? What's your thought on that? A big question, but
yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting if you compare us again to other countries where they have many more political roles, and we have been so Westminster focused, certainly since the Second World War, that we don't have kind of governors, mayors, senators, congressmen, different kind of routes to sort of political power in this country. So I think this is actually going to make political career trajectories much more interesting, as we're seeing people moving between being MPs and being mayors. And it's actually going to lead to less concentration of power in the House of Commons. I think the sorts of people that are starting to say they're interested in becoming a mayor is showing that already.
Yeah.
So, but I do think there is a big job to be done in the run-up to May 2017 to explain to local people what's happening and why it's happening, because the devolution deals have been done behind closed doors for a reason, but they have not been kind of engaging the local population, and trying to explain to local people what powers these new politicians have and why it is worth turning out to vote for them and actually giving them that legitimacy is a big task between now and
that's a great point.
It most certainly is, and I absolutely agree with Joan, everything she said there. I think the evidence suggests for other countries that we're not kind of overgoverned. There may be parts of the country that are, some argue in Scotland there are issues about the amount of elected representatives people have and how it works. But I think taken in the round, I don't believe that's the case. I personally would like to see more development of urban parishes and parish councils. I've always been a fan. Anybody who's got them tells me it's a nightmare and don't ever go there if you ever talk to a local authority leader. But truthfully, if we want to get people engaged in the immediate environment in which they live, you have to go smaller than councillors, even than if you want to do that. I think the challenge for MPs is quite existential, really. What is their role?
Yeah.
What are they there to do?
Yeah.
If you talk to an MP now, they'll say the sort of commons business is done and dusted sometimes by, you know, Thursday, and they're on. It's not that they're not doing anything, but their time spent in Westminster now is really quite short, and you know, just kind of then wonder what's their role really about in those terms.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we're going to see the mayors becoming more and more attractive to kind of backbench MPs as a kind of career option, particularly the more kind of place-based ones who've kind of come up through the sort of local system and local politics, and they've got a really strong constituency affiliation. I think thinking about various career paths that they have, actually thinking about mayors is much more interesting. And again, back to Peter Soulsby in Leicester, being a councillor, MP, leader of the council, and then becoming city mayor, there's some just interesting routes that people...
And, I mean, this is not for subject for this podcast, maybe another one, but for me, central to revitalising our democracy is electoral reform.
Right.
We have a government that is a majority government with less than a quarter of the electorate voting for it. And it just feels to me like one of the ways to reinvigorate both central and local government is to move to a different model.
Yeah. So somewhere along the alternative vote versus and proportional representation.
I would go for that. And the interesting, of course, Scotland has made that move.
Yeah.
And nobody's suggesting going back.
No, no. That's an interesting question around how people, the degree to which people feel that they are represented or not, and have a say on those things in the sense of the people that they vote for. Yeah, I think those are bigger issues, but they are. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the mayoral and the directly elected element of it is a lens through which you can look through some of these bigger issues. Because I think the other one, a bigger issue, is what was termed after the Scottish referendum decision was the English question. Yeah. In the sense, we had, you know, a Scottish government that was becoming increasingly devolved and autonomous, less so in Wales, but nevertheless some shifts, and indeed in Northern Ireland. But the English question remains outstanding, I think, in some respects. And then you have others concerned that devolution is asymmetric, it's on the hoof, it's ad hoc, there's no plan, there's no structure, that's not the way to do all of this sort of stuff. What do you think? What's the English question and the nature of it?
These are really big issues, and I chaired a panel that had a very wide political representation from Greens, Conservatives, people with no political party, to look at some of these issues recently. And it was a fascinating piece of work for me, and some really important conclusions came out of it. One of the most powerful moments was when Gordon Brown spoke to the first meeting of this inquiry panel and talked passionately about needing to establish what he called a voluntary union, united by a set of common principles. I thought it was an immensely powerful statement, actually, of where we need to go on the union. The second most powerful point that came out was from an academic, Bernard Bogdanov, a very respected academic, who has produced a brilliant paper on this action. One of the things he says in this paper he's done is that asymmetry is the price we pay for the union. In other words, to move to a completely federal model with 85% of the population being in one part of that federation is imbalanced. You can't ever, it would fall apart, basically. And if we want to keep the union, we have to live with the fact that it's asymmetric.
Yep.
And I actually buy that argument. Doesn't mean to say we can't move down a more devolved model, a more federal model. But just think of the power of a model that's moved a long way towards federalism, huge devolution in England, and a voluntary union where people choose to be part of that union because of a set of common principles. Just think how different that would be.
Yeah.
And I think we've got some way to go before we see the huge devolution in England. And obviously,
Miles away. Some
people are arguing that this whole debate around devolution deals and directly elected mayors is a distraction from the fact that we've still got a hugely centralised state. So these are kind of baby steps in the direction of decentralisation, really, rather than devolution.
Oh, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And certainly our panel found that we need to move in a much more systematic way towards devolving power in this in England, particularly.
So is that deeper in the places that we see already, Bob, or is that breadth in terms of everywhere?
I think it's
because I think that's the there's you know the Manchester getting more and more and more, London getting more and more and more, Sheffield getting more and more and more, Birmingham getting more and more. Or are we talking about everywhere getting
what's happening to Northampton?
What's happening to Northampton?
It's a fair point.
Yeah,
I actually think it's both. Right. I know that's a cop out at one level, but I think it's genuinely true. The reason I say that is I think We have to find a model of devolution that doesn't wholly rely on mayors and wholly rely on cities.
Yeah.
I feel very strongly that we've got to be up for a much more ambitious model of devolution in this country, much more along the lines of other countries where you have a mix of locally raised income and assigned income from nationally collected taxes.
Yeah.
And I think 100% retention of business rates is a great step forward, but it's not a stable enough base to do the scale of devolution we ought to be thinking about. There are too many challenges with business rates for it to do that role. Equally, alongside this much more ambitious devolution for the whole country, London needs another wave of devolution.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because London is in the grip of a really terrible housing crisis now, and it will not solve that problem without more power going to the mayor. I am convinced about that. Yeah. Mayor and the boroughs, I should say.
I agree with that.
And I think on the breadth versus depth issue, I would agree with Bob that actually it's both. So I think we had an event, for example, last week at the Institute, which actually had people from Manchester, the West Midlands and Sheffield talking about how they're implementing their devolution deals.
Yeah.
And Rachel Jones from the West Midlands made the comment there that actually you need to start relatively small. And if you're not Manchester, you haven't got a 25-year plus history of working together locally in this way. Starting with some policy areas and then building on those over time is actually quite a sensible approach. So yes to more depth, but in a staged way. And on the breadth point, I think the key from our perspective is that the kind of challenges of joining up public services are felt everywhere, and to stimulate growth for that matter. So if you're thinking about things like health and social care integration, we can't only rely on devolution deals and mayors as a process there, because the rest of the country is facing the same challenges, the same budgetary issues.
And what's more, with localising of business rates, you can envisage a healthcare model where if the PCT was brought into the local authority, you've got a combination of national and local income combined to deliver local healthcare. I would say we're more than halfway down that journey. We just need the confidence in the imagination to go a stage further, and I think restricting it to cities and mayors misses out a huge opportunity.
And you're not worried by maybe you are in different ways about the response, which is, well, we don't have the governance and accountability mechanisms and systems to devolve significant resource and or responsibilities. There isn't the corresponding governance and accountability systems in place, and the government would say that's partly why we're driving and we want mayors, is that because we feel, what's your sense, because you hear that a lot, don't you, in a sense of saying we couldn't possibly do more because we worry, crudely, services would decline or money would be poorly spent or decision, there would be corruption or the sports scene. I don't know, what's your...
My personal view is that that is overstated. I can see the value of mayors and accountability, but I don't think you have to have mayors in order to create locally accountable systems.
Yeah.
I think there's perfectly good other ways of doing that at local level. And one of the paradoxes is that we often think about devolution as, if you like, government losing control. There's less control. But in fact, if you look at it, one of the most tightly controlled bits of public spending that hardly ever overspends is local government spending. The bit that is really struggling to stay in its budget is the nationally controlled.
And I think there's also an issue with kind of devolving power is almost held up to a higher standard in some ways. So we're devolving systems that we know aren't always working, whether it's kind of adult skills or health and social care.
Yeah.
So, but we're expecting them almost to be held up to a higher standard when they're devolved.
Yeah.
So this is a big policy experiment, essentially, that we're doing in terms of devolving.
Yeah.
But it's not fair to expect local places to be, far outperforming what's happening at the national level.
No, I agree. That's right. The problem we have a bit at the moment is that policy is moving in two different directions at the same time. At one level, we're devolving to cities. Good news. Another level, we're introducing a bill, or now an act, I should say, the Housing and Planning Act, which will dictate for every single planning application the proportion of a certain type of homes, starter homes, that need to be in that planning application.
Yeah.
So we have massive centralisation going on alongside devolution. And what we don't have in this country is any protection of the local state in a way. So those things would not be possible in other European countries.
So would you then borrow from, or would be in favour of what Graham Allen's talked about, which is almost having a written constitution which sets out more clearly what's expected of the local government?
I certainly think that's worth exploring. At the very least, you need some kind of what I would call ratchet system that stops the kind of ratchet going back, if I can put it that way. So we explored the idea in our inquiry about needing a supermajority in the House of Commons in order to do further centralisation as opposed to decentralisation.
Right.
Now, they don't like supermajority votes, but if we were serious about the agenda of devolution, we would have some constraints on the ability to re-centralise things that you'd already devolved.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's interesting. Yeah. I think in debates we've seen around academies recently, that's a good example of an area of public services that in some senses is going in the other direction in terms of central control. So.
And in the devolution space, I mean, how do we envisage us moving forward? Do we need a national convention that sort of irons all these things out before we make movement? Or do we continue where we are, which is, on a deal by deal, with the intention that we want to do more in more places, deeper in the places that we're ready? I mean, what would be your, what would be the model or way forward? Maybe it's not a model, but the way forward. Where do we, if we want to be more devolved in 5 years' time or in 10 years' time, which I think we probably would be,
do we
need to worry too much about how we're going to get there?
Again, feels like I'm backing both horses, but I think, which I am.
Well, it's a wise position to hold, Paul. You know that.
No, not for a civil servant for nothing. but seriously, I think you genuinely have to try and make advances where you can in the here and now in cities and, push through on individual cases.
Yeah.
So, Manchester pushed through with the backing of their Chancellor on a number of key issues that others have then been able to follow. That's good news.
Yeah.
But I also think we need to step back and do some and set up some processes, that's a better way of putting it, that might lead us to something very radically different.
Right.
And I'm a fan of a constitutional convention that I think could open up the debate in the country. I'm a fan of looking at what a new constitution might look like for the UK. I think these are things that are worth doing. I'm a fan of advancing the agenda around electoral reform.
Yeah.
I know here and now the answer will be no.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how when you start these processes, they lead to change.
Yeah.
If you look at Scotland as the example, a lot of what happened in Scotland came out of a constitutional convention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
And I think the kind of pragmatic sort of tactical process that we're going through at the moment, we've made more progress that way than we have for years in terms of decentralising within England. So there is something to be said for that process, even for those who would like it to be a bit more uniform and so on.
Yeah.
We raised some issues in our report on making devolution deals work earlier this year about Whitehall and local areas nevertheless needing to answer questions about what this devolution means for the whole system.
Yeah.
Because if you're thinking about areas of public services as a whole, devolving some parts to some areas and different things to other areas, you do need a system-wide perspective and someone needs to be leading that and thinking those questions through.
I do agree with that. And I think the one of the challenges with the current model of things is everywhere has been invited to develop its deal.
Yeah.
But only a certain few are actually having a meaningful conversation.
Absolutely.
So it's a bit like everybody being invited to a party and only half a dozen of them get in to the disco. The rest are standing out in the rain wondering what's happening.
And we've not got much clarity about what's happening. So that volume of areas that submitted bids to the September last year deadline that are still...
They're still in limbo.
They're in limbo, and there's no clarity on what will happen.
No.
I think that is kind of unhelpful, actually, and breeds a certain kind of disillusion, if you like, with the process. So I do think that in itself creates a problem. There's also, I think, a view emerging, people won't say this publicly, and I don't blame them in a way, about whether we may be reaching a world in which we have to think about post-deal devolution, that maybe the deal-based approach is getting close
that's
to
right.
its
run its course.
I think that's an interesting point that we should start to think about. Is the next wave of devolution going to look and feel like a deal-based model?
Yeah. In a more devolved context, Joe, I mean, what's the experience of, what would we want from national government and from, you know, from ministers and national departments? I mean, what would you hear it a lot, in a sense, in a more devolved world where they're in theory doing less, notwithstanding the centralisation tendencies that you were talking about earlier on. But, I mean, what would we want them to be doing, or what will they have to be doing?
A couple of things that we've raised that we think that Whitehall and departments should be doing in this sort of system of devolution deals is providing some of that kind of support function to help local places share and learn from each other.
Yeah.
The kind of competitive nature of the process so far has almost worked against people sharing, but actually as people start moving into implementation, we really can't afford to reinvent the wheel in lots of different places, and there need to be ways of bringing those areas together and for areas that are less far along in the process to actually learn from what's happening. I think there's also, it will be a real missed opportunity if central government doesn't play a role in actually evaluating what's happening.
Yeah.
This is a major national policy laboratory live experiment that's going on, and we need to actually learn which bits work and how outcomes are changing in terms of local public services or is economic growth rising in these areas. So I think there's a role there for looking.
Yeah, all of that's right. And indeed, the government, slightly against their will, agreed to do an annual devolution report. So it'll be very interesting to see what appears in that, really. But I think the other thing I would say is that government will have the space, if we get devolution right, to do the sorts of things that they should be doing anyway but don't get around to doing. As somebody who sat in the central government, I've been astonished how the detail crowds out the strategic thinking.
Right.
You know, when you get to be talking about an individual site, a cabinet, and the problem of dealing with the migrating birds on that site, you think something is not quite working here. And there's a huge, what I call fallacy of power at the central government, which is if you can micromanage anything from the centre, you can't. And massive energy goes into stuff that should never come anywhere near central government. And if they didn't happen, they could do the thing which they've been challenged by a number, including IFG actually, for not doing, which is long-term strategic thinking about issues like energy, defence and so on.
Yeah.
And also focusing the government's agenda. So through things like the single departmental plans, they still, some of them read a bit more like manifestos in terms of the number of focuses for departments. Yeah. And I think freeing up some time for strategic thinking and really focusing on what the key priorities are for each department is really necessary.
Yeah, yeah. As we come to a close, we encourage you to look into the future and, you know, 5 or 10 years, and just to give us a sense as to optimistic or pessimistic around this agenda. You know, will we have a dozen big city mayors, you know, being powerful as individuals, but also as a cabinet, being a counterweight to national government as it goes through its own issues around, you know, what it looks like, what it feels like in a devolution context, or will we have regressed in a sense? This will be chalked off as yet another failed policy experiment. The whim of a chancellor that is now doing whatever he is doing, presumably not the prime minister. I don't know. I mean, Joe, give us a sense as to what can we have some thoughts for the future.
I think when it comes to mayors specifically, the kind of key test is going to be whether big political players are interested in becoming mayors.
Right.
And if they are, and if they do, then I think we will see a new kind of powerful force of a different kind of politician in this country. And we're already seeing that with Andy Burnham standing to be mayor of Greater Manchester, and various rumours of Andrew Lansley being a former Secretary of State for Health standing in East Anglia, or indeed possibly Caroline Flint, another former Labour minister in Sheffield.
Yeah.
So I think if we get that kind of cadre of kind of big political players, and again with the London mayoral race, that was an interesting example of Sadiq Khan being Shadow Justice Secretary and Shadow Minister for London and choosing instead to become a mayor, and Boris Johnson obviously re-entering national politics. So if we start to see mayors being taken seriously by big political players, which I think we are starting to see, then I think as with London, we will see more power devolved over time and a kind of new political class emerging.
I'm absolutely with Joe on the big political players point, actually. And we seem to have moved on from the early thoughts there were that the way to invigorate the mayoral model was to have lots of personalities coming through.
Yeah.
We've gone beyond that now, and I think that's a very serious step. So I'm an optimist, actually, about this agenda. Where I'm cautious, I guess, if I'm honest, is whether or not it will result in fundamental changes in outcomes. The work that Sperry have done, the Sheffield Institute, still shows the balance, if you like, in the economy inexorably moving in the wrong direction. We haven't yet found an economic model that allows us to rebalance this country's economy.
I wonder whether we need a political model, a rebalanced political model first.
Well, it's a very good question, and I don't think I know the answer, actually, to this. But I think the direction of travel of devolution now is inexorable. And I think it won't just rely on one chance. After all, if you think about George Osborne, he was not a natural devolver, quite the opposite at the beginning of his time. He came to believe in it through persuasion and argument with the Manchester leadership. Mm. I think it's deeper than one person now. I think it's an underlying expectation and ethos. And despite the frustrations of things going in the wrong direction sometimes, I think the genie's out of the bottle.
My guests today have been Lord Kerslake, Bob Kerslake and Joe Casebourne. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.